first revival that when Mullins was back here in Aberdeen, actually. But the drummer plays cardboard boxes and fishing tackle box and all that stuff that you would really get
with
into.
Triggers?
No triggers. Just you know the kind of thing that you do with your with your drum. And there you see these street musicians too playing just you know turned over.
What I did was my first real job in 1989 was working for Pure Cushion Drums. And so I built this massive drum set, and they were shellless drums. The company finally folded because they just, you know, there wasn't a market for them. But I put triggers on them all, which were 360, you know, triggers. And so I had the best of both worlds. I had the acoustic bleed through the vocal mics.
And then you could adjust them to get whatever.
But I had, in fact, like one time I was playing a gig and I had a kick pedal that had a trigger underneath. And I actually split my kick drum's head, so it was just something like this. But out front, it was going to go boom, 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 because I had my digital triggers.
We have to get a History 152 band together. Bring in your bass. Bring in your bass sometime. Drums. Aaron, are you a musician? Ginger?
I play keyboard.
Keyboard?
Worship band.
Well, that would be neat. Cindy?
And nothing worth listening to. I taught myself how to play the guitar.
Saxophone. Vocals. What do you like better?
Probably vocals.
Chelsea, are you a musician?
I play violin.
Oh, what a neat combination. Kendra? Or Corella?
Play viola.
Viola?
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of Jean Pointe?
Yeah, if I get a little more efficient here, it'd be really fun just to get some America, some things that are important to it, some music that's important to American history, and just to sit here and play music. I have to get a keyboard. Keyboard, bass, violin, and viola. Good.
Like orchestra.
What?
Yellow.
Well, one tangent before I even get started with this. I was talking about Herbert Hoover. Herbert Hoover went to Stanford, and of course, Stanford, he's the most, in many ways, very distinguished alum from Stanford. And there's the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and they built a big tower. It's called Hoover Tower. They're a wonderful library, Hoover Library of War, Revolution, and Peace. Top scholars from all over the world. Alexander Solzhenitsyn made his headquarters there for a number of years, and a number of other very famous people, largely dissidents from the East. Many dissidents from Eastern Europe and Russia. But in any case, the most famous graduate from my theater department at Stanford. Now, the most famous actress to come out of Stanford is Sigourney Weaver. But Sigourney was she was there just a she overlapped with me there, but she was not a drama major. The most famous drama department alum who is not an alum is Richard Boone. Now, if you are old enough, you will remember the old television show Have Gun, Will Trap. Richard Boone played Paladin, very popular Western television series. But Richard Boone did not graduate from Stanford. And the reason he did not graduate from Stanford is that Herbert Hoover's widow, Lou Henry Hoover, was touring the campus and getting, of course, the VIP treatment as the wife of a former president would get. In any case, she's touring the campus, and Richard Boone and a friend of his in the drama department, they got out a prop dummy from the department, very realistic-looking dummy, and managed to get that dummy under the wheels of Mrs. Hoover's car, and then went into their act about, oh no, he's dying! Yes. Richard Boone got kicked out of his head. So the most famous actor to be in our drama department got kicked out.
For overacting.
Yeah, but he had a very distinguished career. Quite a fine actor. If you ever get a chance to see How Gun Will Travel, it is one of the finest of the old westerns. Tremendous. Okay. 1932 election. 1932 election brings to prominence Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, 1932, promised the American people a New Deal, and eventually he gave them just that. Franklin Delano Roosevelt made major changes in many, many aspects of American society. The changes that he brought about made Franklin Roosevelt a hero to many. And Franklin Roosevelt has the distinction of being one of the most loved of all American presidents, with very good reason. But this New Deal seemed to many Americans like a raw deal. And Franklin Roosevelt also has the distinction of being one of the most hated of American presidents, also with good reason. That's an important statement, important because that's what I'm going to talk about in the rest of today's class, and it looks like perhaps the start of Monday's class, and also important because it is study question number 4 for your second midterm exam. One should be able to write on Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the factual stuff, New Deal, all of those programs, what are the changes that Roosevelt made? And then there are the evaluations of Roosevelt. Roosevelt is another of these figures that remains very, very controversial. Roosevelt was and is a hero to many, many people. There are many people, including Dr. Diaz, who was the specialist in the second half of U.S. history. Dr. Diaz, for him, I think Roosevelt, he would consider Roosevelt perhaps the finest of all American presidents in many ways. There are other people, however, who think that Roosevelt is the arch is an arch villain, one of the worst of American presidents, introducing changes to the country that in the long run have not been good at all. Well, I will be interested in your evaluation. You should know both sides of the argument, and I'll be interested in seeing which side of the argument you come down on. Perhaps you might argue that some of what Roosevelt did is good and some not so good, or maybe you don't like the guy at all, or maybe you like the guy and like everything that he does. Let's go back to the 1932 campaign. 1932 campaign, the Republicans are pretty much stuck. Who but Hoover is going to be their nominee? Yes, Hoover wasn't very popular, but there weren't going to be any Republicans that were even more popular. The Republican Party is going to be blamed for the major depression that the country is going through. And so Hoover is going to run again. The Democrats put up Roosevelt. And what's important to understand about the 1932 campaign is that Roosevelt was not specific at all about what he was going to do. In fact, the campaign itself might have even misled people. Some of the slogans that Roosevelt used, no kidding, in 1932, out of the red with Roosevelt. Yes, out of the red. No deficit. You know, he was lambasting Hoover during the campaign, and lambasting Hoover for deficit kind of spending. And also, throw the spenders out. Once again, 1932, Franklin Roosevelt, as he is campaigning, uses slogans, out of the red with Roosevelt, throw the spenders out. But I don't think people were paying attention to that. Oh, maybe at some level they are. But Roosevelt was promising the American people a new deal. Teddy Roosevelt said, a square deal. Roosevelt says, no, what we got to do here is we're going to kind of call in the cards and deal over. If you're playing pinochle, you got a handful of nines. Some people play that if you got six nines in your hands, that's six out of the eight nines, you can throw in the hand and call for a new deal. And other people play with, you know, different card games with different kind of rules. Well, Roosevelt says, hey, we got to get a new deal. And many, many Americans felt, yeah, it's time for a new deal. Let's shuffle cards again and let's see what we can get. Any kind of change has got to be an improvement. Most important, though, I think as far as the American people were concerned, was the mood of the campaign. And this is important to understand in American history, is that people are sometimes affected not so much by the ideas that a candidate will put forth, but simply by the emotional response to a candidate. Roosevelt used as kind of his campaign theme song, Happy Days Are Here Again. It was a very upbeat, very positive campaign. In a time of depression, people want, what do they want? Well, they want hope and they want change. And these kinds of slogans are used again and again and again. These aren't new slogans with Obama. These are the kinds of things that American people have responded to for a long, long time. Well, Roosevelt, not surprisingly, wins a great victory over Hoover. I don't have the specific numbers here, but Hoover is certainly not a popular man, and the American people are going to give Roosevelt his chance to give them a new deal. Well, what does Roosevelt do to make sure that happy days are here again? One of the first things that he does is he gets rid of national prohibition. Very quickly, he gets legislation authorizing the sale of wine and beer, and surprisingly short order, the 18th Amendment to the Constitution is repealed. The only time a constitutional amendment has ever been repealed is the 18th Amendment. Now, you didn't, I don't think that you needed to amend the Constitution to get rid of prohibition. I think that the 18th Amendment simply allowed prohibition, but the opponents of prohibition want to make sure that no, we are not authorized ever to try this great experiment ever again. Well, what difference does this make? One of the things that's very easy is you say, okay, get rid of that experiment with prohibition. It wasn't working very well. It's criminal elements are taking advantage of that and all of that. But there is something else going on here that is long-term a lot more important. Up to this point, the progressive movement, the reform movements in American history had largely come out of the churches. People like William Jennings Bryan, who, three-time Democratic candidate for president, the major voice in some ways for reform for a long, long time in America, deeply religious in his concerns. With Roosevelt, things begin to change. Prohibition had been for many, many of the, what can I say, Christian progressive, Christian populace. Prohibition, temperance, was very, very high on their list. Remember Frances Willard, the Woman's Christian Temperance Union. Strong religious base, but very high on her list, this temperance idea. This is where solid Christians, they had a lot at stake in this prohibition idea. They had been pushing and pushing and pushing. This is the thing that they had wanted for a long, long time. And what happens is that when prohibition is repealed, a lot of these Christian progressives back off. And the progressive movement, the idea, I shouldn't say just the progressive movement, but the cause of reform is now becomes secular in its basis rather than religious. Franklin Roosevelt is not a deeply religious type. Very different from Franklin, William Jennings Bryan, a deeply religious man. Different, by the way, than Woodrow Wilson, who was also, in his own way a deeply... he was the first president of Princeton University not to be an ordained minister. But he still had that kind of old Princeton pastoral type of interest. Now, what difference would this make? What difference would it make if your zeal for reform is based in the Bible, in religion, versus a zeal for reform that's purely secular, that is not connected with a religious impulse? What would be the difference?
You could reach a wider audience.
You could be more realistic.
Okay, so you think this would be an advantage?
You wouldn't have a strict set guidelines to follow. So you may not, your reform may end up being 100 million different directions and have no way to focus.
Okay, very, very quickly, you're getting to what I want you to get to here. I'd say that Franklin Roosevelt brings about major changes in American history. And one of the changes, you know, we're going to get to all the alphabet soup programs in a little bit. But one of the things that is very, very easy to miss is that this is going to be exactly the kind of change that you're pointing to. As your motivation becomes secular, perhaps you're going to be able to reach beyond beyond a core Christian element. Perhaps there are some other kind of concerns there. But what does progress mean? What does reform mean? What are you trying to achieve?
Change.
Just change. You like change?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, we would like a change of professors here. Let's get Shoff to finish the lecture today.
Would you like that, Chelsea? You already heard from Dr. Shoff for 2 hours. Would you like him to come back? Would you like to hear from Shoff for 4 hours?
We actually had a test, so.
Oh, you had a test.
To him, like,
oh, okay. Oh, so you don't have your Shoff. You really would like Shoff back so that he could be. Oh, no, no.
Very animated.
Change. The point that Kendra makes is really, really important here. Because there is a strangeness to reform when you don't have a common core set about. You don't know what you're really aiming for. Now, in Europe, this gets way out of hand. As what happens with the adoption, widespread adoption of first Kantian and Hegelian philosophy, there is an attempt to create a paradise, or there is a view that we can figure out how to create a paradise on Earth. The Hegelian philosophy, in particular, leads to Marxism on the one hand. Marxism, a totally secular philosophy that's designed to create a workers' paradise on Earth. The Hegelian idea also leads to the Nazis. They also are trying to create an ideal society. Heaven on Earth. And again, focuses on Nazi National Socialist Workers' Party. Both the Nazis and the Communists are promising paradise for workers. The Nazis give Germany a paradise. The Communists give workers a paradise. See, there is a real danger. You can see it more easily in European history, but there is a potential danger when you all of a sudden give people power, individuals power, to reconstruct your society, and you don't have a common... It makes a difference. It makes a long-term difference. It changes the nature of reform in America. And by the way, the repeal of Prohibition meant that a certain type of person for a long, long time withdraws from American politics. People that you would call evangelicals today or fundamentalists today, after the repeal of Prohibition, they're just out of politics for a long, long time. Not 100%, but many of them say, we're going to concentrate on our churches, we're going to concentrate on personal salvation, we're going to concentrate on winning people to Christ, we're not going to get involved in politics anymore. And there is a big withdrawal of a certain aspect, a certain percentage of the population from American politics. Well, let me get, I said we got to get to the alphabet soup programs, and we should do that. Franklin Roosevelt, also very early, wants to deal with the banking problem. Banks have been collapsing, runs on banks, and what Roosevelt did was he took steps to make sure that the banks would be more sound. He declared a banking holiday. In other words, you can't take your money out of the bank. The banks are going to be closed, and then the banks are carefully examined and reopened one by one. The bank is reopened when it is declared to be sound. Now, what had been happening here is people would panic, and a bank would be perfectly healthy, but banks don't, banks lend out their money. They've got their money invested in all sorts of different things. They only keep a small percentage of their funds on hand. And if all of a sudden everybody wants their money out of the bank doesn't have the resources to pay off all the people that have deposits there. And so a perfectly healthy bank can go under if there is a run on the bank, if there is a panic, a perfectly sound bank. Well, what Roosevelt did is he said, look, we are going to guarantee you that any bank we open, that bank is going to be sound. You don't have to take your money out of there. And so people could rest assured, okay, the government has promised that our money is safe, no more bank
Was that right,
so as a result of that. I'm going to get to that just a second. No, FDIC. Roosevelt also, and this is important, Roosevelt gets on the radio, the first president to take widespread advantage of this way to connect directly with the American people. He begins a series of fireside chats. Now there would be other topics later for these fireside chats, but initially the fireside chats were designed to reassure Americans, reassure them in the soundness of their banks. Roosevelt connected directly with the American people in a way that no president had before. Here was the president speaking to you in your living room, on your radio. That's one of the reasons that Franklin Roosevelt became such a loved president. This was a president who you felt like you knew this guy. You had heard his voice. Now, he might not have heard your voice, and he might not know you, but you knew him. Roosevelt reassured the American people, but also he took steps to make sure that beyond that confidence level, there were steps taken to make sure that the banks wouldn't go through collapses again. Under Roosevelt, we have the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. This required banks to basically participate in a kind of savings insurance program. The savings insurance program was designed to protect assets up to $5,000. The federal government would guarantee that if you had your money in an FDIC account, you would never lose your money. You would never lose a penny of your money. Why? Because there's an insurance plan in place. FDIC, by the way, worked. No one has ever lost a penny in an FDIC insured account. You don't have to worry about that anymore. You can put your money in. This is something that I think you just take for granted. You put your money in the bank and it's going to be safe. You're not going to lose your life savings. As long as you got your money in a bank account, you're not going to lose your life. If your life savings is there, you're not going to lose it. The government will come in if something happens to your bank. This is another reason Roosevelt is one of the most loved of American presidents, is that for those of us that don't have the time to investigate in financial affairs and things like that, and you know, you got your friendly neighborhood banker and he's got a big smile on his face and he looks trustworthy, but secretly he's doing all these kinds of things to put money into his own pockets, you don't have to worry about that kind of thing anymore because the government has made sure that your money is safe. Roosevelt also sets up the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, to oversee and to regulate securities fraud. The SEC makes sure that information is made public to investors, and this prevents certain kinds of corrupt practices in the stock market. And once again, this was a fairly successful strategy in terms of stabilizing stocks eventually. Now, unfortunately, some of this would later come undone, but at least initially, setting up the SEC to investigate certain kinds of securities frauds was a good move. SEC, Securities Exchange Commission.
Okay.
Roosevelt also did something else to try to stabilize the economy. One of the things that had been happening as the American economy had been crashing in the early 1930s is that Americans panicked and they were afraid of total collapse. And if you're afraid of total collapse, what do you want in your possession? You want gold. Absolutely. You want gold. And so what happens? You convert your paper currency into gold. And what do you do with your gold? Your gold coins, your $5 gold coins, your $10 gold coins. What do you do with it? That's right. You hang on to it. Well, that means less currency in circulation. Oh, if there's less currency in circulation, what happens? The economy shrinks. There is a certain aspect of the economy, and again, you need an economist to explain why this is, but if the money supply shrinks, then the economy will contract. Money makes transactions smoother. It makes it easier. Now you can go the other side. You can have too much money in circulation. You can get inflation, which has problems of its own. But if you have too little currency in circulation, you got real trouble. And that's, by the way, why the free silver people wanted the coinage, free coinage of silver in the reign of 16 to one. They wanted to put more money into circulation because they thought it would, and rightly, I think, that it would stimulate the economy in a certain way. But in any case, Roosevelt stops the hoarding of gold by what? Making it illegal to possess gold. Now you can possess gold for jewelry, but you have to turn in your gold dollars for paper currency. Ultimately, what happens is, what does it say on your money? If you pull out a dollar bill, what's the slogan on your dollar bill? In God we trust. What backs your currency? Faith.
Oh my God.
Faith. The full faith and credit. Oh, the government isn't God, Eric?
Well, they might like to think so.
The government is God. Once the religious element of the reform movement is gone, and the reformers are going to create for us heaven on earth, they're God. Of course they are. Anyway. Taking us off the gold standard, one of these really controversial things, and gold bugs like Professor Newman will tell you that this is one of the worst things that Roosevelt did. Milton Friedman has a real good video with his argument that taking us off the gold standard or making gold inaccessible, the United States government starting to hold gold, is one of the problems that aggravates this depression. Anyway, that's certainly... controversial. More significant for the immediate needs of the American people, how do you deal with unemployment? Remember, unemployment had gone to a quarter of the American people, 25% of the American people out of work. What Roosevelt did is he stole a page from Herbert Hoover's playbook. Herbert Hoover had tried to address the unemployment thing by massive government projects. Roosevelt launches projects that dwarf those of Hoover. Programs like the TVA. Now, for many people working on these TVA projects, you get a job with the government, that's neat. For many people that profit, the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, brought electrification to a substantial portion of the country in that Tennessee Valley area. If you're getting cheaper electricity, you might like that. If you're getting a job, you might like that. However, this put the federal government directly in competition with private developers of energy resources. Wendell Welke, for instance, controlled an electric, was involved in the electric industry. He was furious with Roosevelt because he thought that private industry could supply electricity better and cheaper. He didn't want the government intervention there. And Welke left the Democratic Party. He later becomes, in 1940, he becomes Roosevelt's opponent on the Republican side. And so even at the time, there were people that were really angry with Roosevelt for these public works programs because they really thought that he was putting the government in charge of things that the government didn't do as well as private enterprise could do them. Roosevelt also created the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps. In times of economic hardship, one of the worst potential problem groups is young men. Unemployed young men turn to crime, create all sorts of problems for you. They got a lot of energy. They can be really bad news. CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps. Okay. The CCC hired young men to go out and do conservation type projects, fire prevention types of things, other things related to that. A portion of the pay of these young men sent home for their families. Now, this is important for a lot of different reasons. First of all, it's important because you take these young men off the streets, you give them something that they feel is worthwhile. And if, look, you got a bunch of people in Germany at the time that will rally to an Adolf Hitler. Young men who can't find decent jobs. They are so angry that they could be recruited to follow a man like that. In Italy, you get the same thing. the same, well, actually even a little earlier, you get angry young men who don't have decent jobs, who flock to Mussolini's banners. These young men can be dangerous both individually and feeding into crime groups, but also very dangerous politically. And Roosevelt does something to diffuse that anger by giving these young men jobs that are actually appealing. I mean, how many of you would like a job? Yeah. Tennessee Valley Authority. George Foreman. You guys know George Foreman? Boxer guy? Who has, what, six sons and named it all George? What?
He named his girl George, too.
Okay. Anyway, Foreman came out of a similar type of program, and it turned his life, in some ways, at least, it turned his life around. Now, that's a different program, a later program, but that's the kind of thing that the CCC is doing. Roosevelt also started the WPA. WPA, the Works Progress Administration. This was another government job creation program designed to create all sorts of things. And you can't travel in this country without coming across still the WPA projects. Think Richmond Lake is a WPA PA project. I'm not absolutely sure, but there are many other bridges and all sorts of things. Swimming pools sometimes, public buildings. There are all sorts of things that are WPA projects. And once again, we're putting people to work. Particularly important in the WPA is that it put intellectual types to work. I told you that angry young men are a potential danger to a society. Also a potential danger to a society are angry intellectuals. In many, many countries around the world, well, Crane Britton wrote a book called The Anatomy of Revolution. And in that book, Crane Britton says that before you have a revolution, one of the things that happens is the alienation of the intellectuals. When the thinker types don't like your society, then your society is ripe for revolution, and maybe even a radical revolution. What happened here is that the WPA programs put these unemployed intellectuals, and what are we talking about? We're talking about writers, we're talking about artists, we're talking about college professors, yes. It put them to work doing what? Well, if you go to the Northern Library and you look for it, you'll be able to find all of these interesting research reports done with WPA money. This is something important that Roosevelt has done, is he gives these intellectuals something to do, and maybe things that they wouldn't have, in other circumstances, would never have been done. Lots of interesting things still come out. I mean, there are times when historians, I'm an ancient historian, so I don't do many of this, but for U.S. historians, there are very often times when somebody working on a WPA grant gave you exactly the information you need. Just out of curiosity, every once in a while, some of my students, when they're doing History Day projects or something, will come across WPA work. Any of you ever have that experience?
I think Lake Hiddenwood is.
Pardon?
Lake Hiddenwood is a project that
they really wanted to do. Yeah. Anyway, WPA important as well. Beyond that, what do? You've also got people that, you know, you can't make enough work for everybody. You got your WPA projects, you got your CCC projects, what do? Roosevelt has another program, FERA, Federal Emergency Relief Act. And this act is a major, major change in government policy. Up to this point in American history, Americans were extraordinarily reluctant to have government involved in any direct charity to individuals. The dominant idea was that if the government gives people money, if the government supports them, gives them their housing, gives them their food or whatever, you will create a parasitic class. You will create a class that is dependent on the government. It will undermine people's willingness to work. Now, is there any truth to that idea?
Yeah.
There is a lot of truth to that idea. And Roosevelt himself knew that there was a potential problem here. Nevertheless, conditions were so bad in this country that Roosevelt felt it had to get the government involved. So you get FERA, which for the first time really provides government relief to people that are impoverished for one reason or another. And one of the interesting things is that FARA money, distributed usually through local government organizations, even there, as much as possible, the concern was to make it workfare rather than welfare. Even if the only thing that you have for somebody to do is rake leaves, it's better to pay them for raking leaves than to pay them for doing nothing. Nevertheless, Roosevelt, even though he is as careful as he can be with this, he is the one that opens up the door to the policies that we will later have of massive government aid. Now, this heats up with the Johnson administration. I'll talk about that much later. Also, trying to get the economy going again, Roosevelt wants to address some of the problems with labor. Roosevelt creates the NRA. Now, in this case, NRA stands for two different things. The National Recovery Act that puts this legislation in place, and the National Recovery Administration that administers this program. The NRA, and of course the NRA is the National Rifle Association too, but that doesn't have an NRA. National Recovery Administration, National Recovery Act, is one of those things that that guarantees some of the things that American workers had wanted for a long time. It guarantees the right to collective bargaining. It forbid no union contracts, sets minimum wages. In return for that, the National Recovery Administration authorized businesses to get together so that they could keep prices high. It allowed the businesses to do what earlier would have been considered kind of a corrupt business sort of a practice. Now, most people do not like, many people do not like the NRA. People at the time said that the NRA was the national runaround because you had to go to a government agency to figure out how you were going to do all sorts of different kinds of things. And others say NRA stands for Nuts Run America, which is often true even today. But the NRA does strengthen the labor movement, and that is one of the reasons that Roosevelt secured for him a lasting place in the hearts of many Americans, people that tended to be union members and things like that. They looked to Roosevelt as a man who finally made the unions effective for a time. And then, yes?
Oh, okay. I caught two of the things that it says. It guarantees collective bargaining and minimum wage. What was the other
collective
one?
Bargaining, minimum wages, no non-union contracts.
Okay.
You can't forbid people from joining unions.
All right, thank you.
Farm policy. Another controversial one. AAA, the Agricultural Adjustment Act. And once again, put in place by an Agricultural Adjustment Administration. The AAA you want to keep commodity prices high. Why are commodity prices low? Overproduction. And so what do? This is the beginning of federal government programs, basically to pay farmers not to plant crops. But wait. When this act is passed, the crops are already planted. And so what did you do? The first year, farmers were paid to plow their crops under. They were paid to slaughter their hogs without putting them on the market. And this is one of the things that many Americans really, wait a minute, what are we doing? We are destroying perfectly good, when people are going hungry, we are plowing crops under. When people are going hungry, we're slaughtering hogs. Roosevelt also, in terms of agriculture, get the Soil Conservation Act. Soil Conservation Act, once again, paid farmers to change their practices, let land lie fallow, plan not to plant again, also plant soybeans instead of what you might have planted otherwise. Now, the Soil Conservation Act, I think it was less controversial than the AAA in some ways, but notice a potential problem here. Who do these payments go to? They go to the people that own the land. And one of the things that Roosevelt's agricultural programs lead to eventually and indirectly is the growth of our big agricultural, you see, a small farmer could not take advantage of these government programs, as well as the bigger farm corporations. And one of the things that happens here is these big corporations can take advantage of these programs. Also, it's the people that own the land, not the people that work the land, that benefit. If you are a tenant farmer in the South, and the person that owns your land decides they're going to lie fallow, let it lie fallow so that they can get paid by the government for not planting land, what happens to your job? It's gone. And so this is another of the Roosevelt programs that it benefits some people, but then other people were kind of angry with it. Let's stop here. I'll pick up three more Roosevelt programs in our next exciting lecture, and then we'll move on to happier things like World War II.
That was intriguing.
So much for my plan. 20 minutes early and instead 10 minutes late.
Don't you know yourself better?
You know, I'm just too tired. I had to say goodbye to my son and my daughter-in-law, my grandkids. So we stayed up very late last night. We got up very early this morning, and so I'm tired. And the funny thing about me is that when I get tired, I get much less efficient. I do get off onto sidetracks more often.
That's just a scientific fact.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that your visit ended.
You know,
but at least it was a good visit, though. You did a lot of things. You had to go watch the grandkids swim.
Oh, yeah.
And it sounds like you had a lot of late night conversations with your kids.
I ended up spending more time with my granddaughter than with my son. Just didn't work out.
But he
got to spend time.
That's worth a lot, you know. I mean, I